Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. In this episode, we are joined by Daniel Strauss, Director and Head of National Bank Financial's ETF Research and Strategy Group, about the ETF landscape in Canada and the US, as well as recent market conditions. Daniel heads National Bank Financial's ETF Research and Strategy Group, which focuses on providing both institutional and retail investors with value add and actionable investment research relating to exchange traded funds. His group regularly publishes street leading reports on the ETF landscape in Canada and the US, including theme pieces, flow reports, model portfolios, trade ideas, and strategy reports. Their ETF research has been regularly featured in media outlets such as BNN, National Post, Bloomberg, Les Affaires, and the Globe and Mail.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Daniel, welcome. It's terrific to have you back and have this chance to catch up with you at this moment in markets and the economy.
Yeah, thank you, Pierre. It's great to be here.
So, Daniel, it's been quite a wild start year to date in 2024. Equities had a fabulous first half of this year. U.S. equities, the S&P 500 in particular, have been on a tear to new all-time highs led by AI stocks, among other things, as well as, you know, the Fab Five or whatever it is today.
Magnificent Seven now is what people say.
We're back to the Magnificent Seven now. Yeah. And now, with the exception, of course, we had a blip in March and April, and that was tied to the bond market. At least it looks like it was. U.S. Treasuries, Canada bonds, the rates market, on the other hand, in particular at the longer end of the yield curve, have had a very volatile first half in 24. And that's telling investors a whole other story. The 10-year Canadas were as high as 429 in October. They dropped to 306 in late December, back up to 386 in late April, which coincides with that blip in the equity market. And then, of course, following the Bank of Canada led policy rate cut this month, we saw a decline of yields back to 332, which is where they sort of stand, I think, at the start of today, which is June 21st. Daniel, what's the mood and outlook for markets and the economy at National Bank?
Sure, Pierre. Well, thank you. I think you encapsulated it well. It's true that right out of the gate at the start of the year, there was some optimism around the resilience and economic signals from both Canada and the U.S. Within the ETF landscape, we did notice a lot of our clients and investors shifting from U.S. equities into international. I think that that wasn't so much sentiment related as it was just perhaps profit-taking, especially with the leadership of the Magnificent Seven stocks. There were many ETF investors who felt that their U.S. allocation may have started to become a bit toppy, and they were looking to diversify elsewhere into markets that were not so perhaps dominated by giant mega-cap tech stocks. And for that reason, we did see inflows, especially at the start of the year, into EFI equities, Europe, international, developed, and so on. Canada, still with inflows year to date, but in a distant third place. It's a bit of a head scratcher, we think, as to why Canadian equities are still somewhat on the outs. They're not exactly an outflow territory, unless you look at the energy sector, which we can talk about a little bit. But there was definitely positive sentiment around U.S. equities at the start of the year, with some overflow, shall we say, sloshing out into international equities. But in this moment right now, as you said, it's June 21st. I believe it's the summer solstice date.
That's right.
You know, I don't know if we're going to have any ceremonies after the call, you know, in the noonday sun. But there are some worrying signs. You know, I consider myself an optimist. You know, I like to see the cup half full. But our economists and strategists have pointed out that there have been some inflection points and crossing points in our kind of post-pandemic reality. Pierre, last time we talked, I believe we were still kind of in the throes of lockdowns or perhaps just coming out. And now it's 4 years after the pandemic, and only now is there a crossover point in the household spending and savings rate that our economists have noticed. Basically, for the first year and a half of the pandemic, there was a big buildup of savings because expenditures were below trend for in households and families, especially in Canada. This buildup caused, perhaps it may have been a contributing factor to the inflation that we observed with people having more disposable income on hand as a result of less discretionary spending because of lockdowns, more stimulus entering their bank accounts. We're referring to perhaps the top quartile of society where the actual, most, consumer spending is. So this is certainly not a distributed phenomenon, but about a year and a half into the pandemic, household expenditures started to rise above trend. And we did see evidence in the data that families have been digging into their savings. And now we're at a kind of crossing point where perhaps on average, they've been depleted expenditures are still above trend. So that is a worrying sign because the only way that it can be sustainable is through three mechanisms. One is credit, an increase in family borrowing. The other is wage growth has to keep up with that. And it has been in the initial stages of this kind of inflationary period that we're in right now, but lately it hasn't been. The third is that the amount of savings has to go down. All three of these, economic indicators are showing worrying signs, a buildup of credit, reduction of savings, and in fact, wage growth has started to slow down, which means that the stresses on families, especially in the Canadian economy, are likely to continue to grow. It's not exactly the seeds of I don't want to say that's a foregone conclusion. It's not deterministic that we're entering a recessionary period, but all three of these signs coming from different directions have caused our economists and strategists to kind of send signals that they're starting to kind of curtail their optimism and want to kind of suggest to clients to be a little bit more defensive and protective in the coming periods.
Well, that's what's so wonky about this market, and is that for the longest time we've had this added this as investors we've had this idea that if we get bad news that's good news for stocks, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that if the bad news becomes too bad, that's not good, right? Because it'll affect earnings, it'll affect consumption, it'll affect employment.
Yeah.
And until that actually happens, there's no way other than trend watching, watching what's going on in the reporting of, jobs and wages and other inflationary measures.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're happy that prices that the rate of increase in prices is slowing.
Mm-hmm.
But if things change too quickly, yes, it'll mean maybe more rate cuts, more rapid reaction from the Fed and from the Bank of Canada. I think the views, and then we have this divergence, obviously, between what's happening in Canada versus what's happening in the U.S.
Right.
And the Fed seems to be, waiting, playing this waiting game, to get more evidence. But the U.S. economy is more resilient than the Canadian economy, for any number of reasons.
Yeah. There, speaking of of an inversion of expectation and a reality that seems topsy-turvy, there's so much about the U.S. economy that, I think will necessitate in the future a rewriting of economics textbooks, right? There's so much that has happened in recent history throughout the pandemic and certainly since the financial crisis where outcomes very much diverge from expectations. Perhaps you remember, I don't know if it was the last one or the one before the debt ceiling crisis when there was because it's happened multiple times since the 2008-09 financial crisis when the U.S. approaches its kind of on paper debt ceiling and then there's some political brinksmanship taking place in Congress with various politicians arguing that we're not going to approve a debt ceiling and then there may be government shutdowns and reductions of government spending, perhaps even a default on bond payments, which is, a sacrosanct element. It's effects, I believe, in enshrined in the U.S. Constitution that its faith and credit should never be questioned, which is why in all our economics textbooks, as I was saying before, kind of encode U.S. Treasury bills as the risk-free asset, right, as the safest possible asset. But if the U.S. has a kind of political mechanism by which it can maybe default on its debt, even though they could always print more money. If a default can occur because of a debt ceiling, kind of bureaucratic roadblock, that is what caused the credit agencies to reduce, the rating on U.S. Treasury debt from AAA to AA, I believe, a number of years ago.
Right.
Now, if that happened in any other country, a downgrade in credit rating should mean an increase in yields, right? This is what the economics textbooks tell us. But what happened during that crisis was, a decrease in yields. It meant that, oh no, an economic apocalypse is about to occur. And so let's fly to safety, which is the very self same treasury bonds, which just got the downgrade, right? So, it was, only in the United States would a downgrade in the credit rate cause people to panic and buy what else? What else could they buy, right?
Yeah.
U.S. Treasury debt. So I think that, in the future, looking back, perhaps this moment that we're in right now will seem like something that's been conjured up by satirists, right? It seems almost impossible to believe,
yeah,
because who knows what the new world order will be, right? I think that if you've had other macroeconomists on your show on this podcast, you know, which I would listen to with great interest, I've heard it said, I don't want to attribute it to anyone in particular, but perhaps other forms of assets may become what's called the kind of world reserve or world risk free. You know, certainly we know that the US's geopolitical, adversarial competitors want right. their kind of global economies and the global currencies to be seen as an alternative to US dollar. It's almost impossible to question in this kind of post-World War II order that we've kind of benefited from for so long. It's been stable for so long with some worrying signs, but who's to say what the future will hold? And looking back at this moment, it might seem quite absurd indeed.
Absolutely. I almost feel like, speaking recently to a bond fund manager, mm-hmm. My question for the bond fund manager was, what are you optimistic about?
Mm.
Right. And, yeah. and so, I mean, that's a twofold question for a bond manager,
yeah.
for a fixed income manager. And that's that, investors have tons of opportunity hugging the, up to 5 years duration, like something, mm-hmm. in the shorter end. The belly of the curve,
yeah,
would be where the easiest, like the low hanging fruit of the fixed income market are. So yields are a high, so there's an opportunism about nearer term yields, but then the other source of optimism is the pessimism, right? It's always
right.
this
yeah.
invert, you refer to it as an inversion, but
yeah.
They're looking like, as a bond manager investing in duration, you're looking forward to bad news that would trigger a Absolutely. Decline, and that's kind of what we've seen this last couple of weeks with the Fed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know, because you were pausing on pausing.
That's right. Yeah, no. Right. Like we discussed at the beginning of the year, there was quite a bit of optimism around yeah. the markets. I believe the consensus expectation for rate cuts from the Fed was 3 or 4 throughout the year, which has now dropped to 1. They haven't
yeah.
cut. Bank of Canada has cut from down to 4.75. So the divergence in the spread in the short term between the Fed funds rate and the bank overnight rate has grown, which is worrying news for the Canadian currency, but right. perhaps. Suggest that on a relative basis, our economy will be further stimulated by a more aggressive cutting path. It's very difficult to forecast. And there are ETFs to play either side, right?
Yeah.
We know for a fact that when we're talking about flows, because we analyze the flows every day, for the past year or two, there's been an unbelievable phenomenon, certainly through, 2023 and part of 2022 as well. As rates were rising, one of the worst performing bond funds was receiving the best flows. And I'm of course referring to ELT. Exactly.
Right,
The iShares 30-year Treasury bond ETF, which is something of a bellwether. It's a benchmark for ultra long government right. exposure in the US. And it declined by, I think, 30 or 40% from peak to trough through that, you know, the fastest hiking cycle in history. It's a kind of maximum drawdown that you would be accustomed to in your equity investments. But I see a kind of fortress capital like position decline by that much. Well, of course, it makes sense if you know the math of duration and you're a bond manager and you understand it. But I believe that there were probably quite a few investors and traders on the street who saw the kind of label on this ETF, 30-year treasuries, and with a perhaps incomplete understanding of what that actually means, saw it declining, thinking this has got to be a buying opportunity. There's no way that these bonds are going to recover at some point, right?
Right.
And so the inflows into TLT was billions and billions of dollars. It was one of the highest inflow categories through 2023, or perhaps the prior year. It depends on where, how you shift your windows. But absolutely, month after month after month, fixed income investors were trying to catch that falling knife.
Yeah.
You know? You know, perhaps some of them got burned because now that it's finally stabilized, we haven't really seen that pattern. In Canada, we observe kind of echoes of this kind of behavior. You know, our biggest bellwether benchmark fixed income ETFs, I'm referring to the likes of XBB from iShares or ZAG, which is the same index from BMO. Right. Vanguard has a few too. There's a number from other competing ETF providers. They just hold the Canadian bond universe, which is every bond that's issued between government and corporates in a purely passive way. And the kind of outcome of doing that, because there's really no target duration when you're building a portfolio this way, you're just buying everything.
Right.
What you end up getting is the weighted average term duration and yield to maturity of the entire bond market. And that's about 7 or 8 years. It was actually declining over time, but it's now about 7 or 8 years, which is not as long as a 30-year bond, right?
It's fairly high.
But it's still fairly high. Exactly. Yeah. And it is a lot of risk if rates are low, right? And that is, in fact, what happened. So during the pre-pandemic ultra-low rate environment, it would have seemed natural to use these kinds of fixed income products as your core allocation within fixed income. But what we communicated over our years, you know, at the ETF research desk at National Bank was, unless you're, I don't know, liability matching or you're doing some other kind of purpose with your fixed income portfolio, for regular retail investors, perhaps when rates are very low, a 7 or 8 year duration is too high. Perhaps you should be targeting 4 or 5 years. That's what our economist strategists suggested, just as a means of a risk mitigation. And it ended up providing a little bit of outperformance in our model portfolios through that period. And for clients who were kind of following their advice and advisors who were, they still used those ETFs. They still used the core bond ETFs, but they mixed them with short-term instruments, things like cash,
right?
Cash instruments in Canada. There's been a lot of innovation in that space. Some recent regulatory changes, in fact, that have reduced yields as well in that category. So there's been a flurry of activity, billions of dollars of flows into other kinds of short-term instruments. So we can talk about that as well. But,
sure.
You know, I certainly don't envy fixed income managers. I don't envy the portfolio managers who read our ETF research every day and put it into practice. I feel very privileged to be able to speak about these things philosophically from a high level and then entrust my own personal asset management to a blind discretionary account, because we follow the markets every day. We try to give our advice in a neutral and objective manner to the advisors, portfolio managers, and institutional managers who follow our research. But they're the ones who actually are with their career on the hook, shall we say, when they put the advice into implementation by picking and choosing which ETFs to buy.
Very interesting. And Daniel, what are the trends that are shaping the ETF market right now?
Sure.
Equities, first of all, US, Canada, international. You mentioned there was a sort of ramping up at the beginning of the year into international funds.
Yeah.
And then we can get into what's happening in terms of, you know, what's actually happening with flows into bonds, bond funds, bond ETFs.
Yeah.
And then any distinctions that you're seeing.
Sure. Yeah. So, from a very high altitude, the ETF industry has never been more booming and more burgeoning. You know, yes, there were enormous flows in the kind of pandemic year of 2021. I want to say the kind of V-shaped recovery. There were almost $50 billion of inflows in Canada that year. But already year to date, there's upwards of $30 billion in flows. There's buying in all sorts of different categories in the U.S. too, hundreds of billions of flows. I believe the U.S. ETF industry is closing in on $8 trillion there. You know, for a long time, there was enormous retail and institutional interest in the technology space, right? So there was quite a bit of activity in, I want to say, AI and automation. There were some thematic ETFs in that space a number of years ago that received incredible inflows. And now there's a huge amount of headline and ink spilled and thought think pieces on what's it all going to mean for our own careers, right? In the future, right? It's not only about automating factory work or manual labor with robots. It's about automating, you know, white collar work, things like maybe even ETF research, right?
Yeah.
I'm certain that it's coming. We've started to use some of these tools a little bit in our workflows to mind-boggling results. So I think that there is still a lot happening in the economy there and in the ETF landscape to kind of reflect that. You know, within fixed income, especially in Canada, the cash ETFs, and by that I refer to the original, you know, PSA from Purpose. It's a high interest savings account. There's one with the ticker symbol cash from Global X, formerly Horizons, but it's now branded as Global X. Right. Evolve has one, HISA. There's a number of others for both Canadian and US dollar cash. These were incredibly popular products since 2013 because they had a clear value proposition over just bonds. Like a savings account, they never declined in NAV, and they paid a yield higher than actual bonds, right? Yes, you're getting kind of the corporate issuer credit risk from a depository institution, but for fixed income allocation, it was very, very hard to compete with, especially after tax, where bonds have, you know, perhaps capital declines that don't offset their income gains and so on. So there were a number of reasons why investors were flocking to those. There was an OSFI decision that around the way the banks account for those cash deposits that are backstopping those ETFs.
Right.
They were forced to account for those with a higher one-day run risk. So that meant yields declined by a little bit, about 50 basis points in our analysis. And now money market ETFs and other short-term instruments are very, very competitive. So within the Canadian context, we're seeing flows kind of rotate a little bit between cash and money market securities. But interestingly, we often see large waves of outflows from cash and short term when there is optimism, right? These cash ETFs function as mattress cash, right? It's the cash that's underneath your mattress. So when you're optimistic about the market, you pull it out and you try to put it to work. So that's what we've observed. That's what we saw at the start of the year. So it's hard to tease apart the kind of individual strains happening simultaneously, but that's what we do.
Speaking of these high interest savings account type of funds, one of the discussions we had with Jeff Weniger and Samuel Rhines at WisdomTree was around the discussion. You know, the discussion was around the fact that a lot of people, a lot of consumers still have, you know, a ton of cash sitting in bank accounts earning nothing.
Yeah.
And so Jeff Weniger was basically saying that, you know, you don't understand like how many calls. How many people are coming to me and saying, you know, Jeff, I've got this account over at, you know, Wells. And, you know, I mean, I think the same thing applies to Canada as well, which I've got this bank account over at, you know, at my bank and you know, I'm not getting anything for it. What should I do with it? And, you know, like the first thing is that you don't understand how often that happens. And my answer is, you know, why don't you move it over? You know, at the very minimum, without doing anything, any further thinking, why don't you move it over to a short-term T-bill fund that's at least yielding, you know, 4 to 5%.
Right.
Or you know, high interest savings account. But I wonder, you know, it makes you wonder how many Canadians are sitting with, you know, 6 months or a year of cash savings that is just sitting there earning nothing because...
Yeah. Or losing in real terms, right? With inflation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Inflation so higher than the rates here. It's actually declining in purchasing power over time.
You know, they could be getting 4%, 3 to 4% on that money or 5%. I mean, it's amazing. So to see that there's a continuation of flows happening in that space, it just shows that there's a lag in the reaction. Like people are suddenly, you know, cottoning on to, hey, wait a second, you know, I'm getting 0 over here. I could be getting 4 over here.
That's right.
And then doing it. So, you know, these things, you can see the popularity, long as rates stay higher for longer,
right?
You know, you can see where this trend will continue to unfold. And without even considering longer term investment options or you know, strategic holdings. So what's happening in, right now in equities? Is there, is there any slowdown in some sectors and ramping up in others that you're seeing?
Right. So, you know, the, harkening back to what you were just saying about investor behavior, perhaps with a lag and being slow to respond, to answer your question, it is absolutely something we observe in the flow patterns. At the start of the year, every year, January and February in particular, in Canada, there's a huge wave of flows as investors do their last minute RRSP contributions. Of course, they could do these all year, but when they find out perhaps from their accountants how much room they have or whatnot, they will, you know, rush at the last minute to make their contributions. And in fact, since ETFs can serve as this, we definitely see flows in January, February related to the kind of RSP contribution season. And since I've been doing this for about 14 years now, I can see the kind of different tenor sentiment and flavor that each calendar year has, depending on how those flows in particular kind of land in different kinds of asset classes. So to answer your question, the multi-asset category has been something of an evergreen recipient of flows since, I want to say, 2017, when Vanguard somewhat kind of gave a shot in the arm to this category by introducing a suite of three with growth, balance, and conservative allocations. At ultra low costs, something like 25 to 27 basis points. Right. So now, since that time, you have been able to buy in Canada a kind of 80-20 or 60-40 portfolio, one ETF, which is itself a bundle of six or seven others with a very low bundling fee, and set it and forget it, right? So we know that self-directed investors have loved these. And certainly during RSP season, those products, and they receive inflows every single month, those products in January, February of every year, there's something of a local peak. You can definitely see a seasonality in the flows to those products because of those RSP contributions. And interestingly, because those ETFs are themselves ETFs of ETFs, we see the kind of knock-on flows happening, fanning out into the other sub-asset classes. So we have a mechanism to kind of correct for double counting and to see what the true economic flows are into each individual category. But Pierre, to answer your question, in 2023, this period, and I'm talking about the previous calendar year, right?
Right.
I had the highest ever noted inflows into particularly the kind of aggressive allocations, right? Growth was always very, very popular, more so than balanced, which was more popular than conservative, because people want returns, right? People want higher returns. Where you're going to get that, you can only get that from the more aggressive asset allocation schemes, one with higher allocations to equities. At the start of 2024, so yeah, I'm sorry, it was 2024 with the, where they started off very, very high. In 2023, where people were scarred by 2022's bear markets, where they were very low. So let me just amend a little bit what I said. We started this year very optimistically, huge spike in those flows to asset allocation ETFs. At 2023, we were coming off brutal bear markets in both stocks and bonds for 2022, and particularly for bonds as well. So so there was a something of a local minimum in those flows at that time. And at that time, huge inflows into cash, right? So I was just looking at the data at our at the top five, for instance, products at the start of 2023. They're all cash products with one international equity. But this year, the top five were all U.S. equities and an international equity, and then one little cash ETF as well. So, you know, talking about lags, right? The world seemed to have become a mirror image of itself, but with something of a time lag. So we definitely see within the investor behavior of the ETF buying public in Canada, you know, performance chasing. We see a kind of a time lag to headlines and reactions around things like, as I was saying before, AI and high tech ETFs, where the flows kind of very much sometimes follow the very strong stock performance and things like NVIDIA. So, you know, ETFs are wonderful. They're the best, we believe, solution right now in the markets for long-term investors to kind of invest passively or even actively for a very long time and save on costs. But because they're intraday tradable, they still allow people to fall prey to kind of like the worst impulses they have when it comes to investor behavior or misbehavior.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, like I can't tell you how many times, you know, we've laughed about the conversation piece is, around stocks like Google and Amazon historically is like, if Amazon drops 60%, I'm a buyer, I'm a buyer at 50, 60% drop. If Facebook Meta, Meta drops 60%, I'm a buyer, and then it happens. It happened with Meta, for example, in the last 2 years. And, who were the buyers? Where were the buyers when the stock was down, 60%? Where were the buyers when Google was down 90% drawdown? And where, where were the buyers when Amazon did the same? Nowhere. They were nowhere to be seen. And people, look back and say, oh, if only I could have bought it, 90% off. But at 90% off, at 40% off, the stock market looks really unattractive to investors' impulses.
Yeah. That's right.
So, so they do gravitate to, cash. I'm just going to put it in cash right now and wait and see what happens. You mentioned at the beginning of 24 that investors were concerned about the toppiness of U.S. equities and started shifting to international. Yeah. But U.S. equities continued this, first 6 months of the year have continued to dominate world markets, and led by, 5 to 7 stocks, right?
Yeah.
So, what do you do? Now we're six months into this year. NVIDIA is pussyfooting around with being the most valuable company in the world.
Right.
Versus Apple and Microsoft. Yeah. And you look at that and you think like, why, is it prudent to buy anything in a large amount that contains these 3 or 5 stocks? Canadians especially remember, Nortel. You talked about catching a falling knife. The investors, loading up on TLT. Now they weren't all long investors, but there are the notional flows of that were going into TLT were just gangbusters last year. Yeah. Just continuously buying and buying and buying. Now there was some relief from all that long duration investment this last month, or so with. U.S. Treasury yields in the 10 and 30s, receding from their 4.7 peak, 4.7 or 4.8, percent peak recently. How much relief is that when all the way through the buying, of the last 2 years that was going on, it's not like it's hard to reconcile. And that's what makes it so wonky is that, you got all this money flowing into long bonds. You got all this money, flowing into equities. In the meantime, correlations have been positive, for those two core assets.
Yeah.
Are there any distinctions that you can make in investors make poor tactical decisions. Yeah. Hopefully their strategic decisions are much more compelling.
Right. Yeah.
Model portfolio building and things like that. But those tactical flows that come in, like at RSP time, are the ones that are just let's put it in this did so well last year, let's put it there.
That's right. Yeah. So I do want to say that I don't want to disparage the kind of collective wisdom of the investor crowd too much because it's sometimes easy to kind of find examples of bad behavior and chuckle a little bit or at least scratch your head as to understanding what explains it. But I think sometimes in a roundabout way, it is quite rational, particularly when it comes to tax loss season, right? One of our most popular research pieces was, in fact, kind of motivated by client questions that we were getting from advisors who had client portfolios perhaps within a particularly bad bearish calendar year with large loss positions. And they're trying to encourage their clients to diversify their portfolios, reduce their dependency on single stock holdings, and given such large book losses, what can they do to kind of at least increase help the tax position of such investors? So roughly around November of each calendar year, although in some prior years, particularly 22 when it was bad, we put it aloud a little earlier. We published a report on tax loss harvesting. This is something that, for instance, the direct indexing algorithms do automatically. There are certainly automated kind of computational ways to do this. But we publish a report in which we show which are the stocks that have the highest decline from either a recent peak or within the calendar year? And are there ETFs that you can cycle into that offer exposure to perhaps a recovery, right? And this is very, very important for clients who have these losses on their books. And if they sell that position, they recognize the large capital loss, which can be applied forward indefinitely. It can be applied backwards going 3 years, right? It can be used to offset gains in the same calendar year. You can crystallize this tax asset. Again, this is a tax discussion, so I always advise listeners and our readers, please consult with your resident tax expert. We're not tax experts here at the ETF research team at National Bank, but we still publish this report as an aid because very often there will be an ETF that has a large position in this stock, right? Some ETFs are extremely diversified. Some of our favorites, in fact, hold thousands of stocks, like the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index. Holds every stock in the world that qualifies for the index is almost 10,000 securities. The U.S. stock market alone is 4,000 securities, right?
Right.
But there are ETFs out there that are very concentrated. And although they're not as diversified as a total stock market index ETF, they would make an ideal tax loss switch because it's at least more diversified than a single stock, right? If it holds 30 or so stocks, right? If it holds 30 or so stocks, its weight in each one, for instance, might be 3% and change, right? This will give you some, not a lot, but some exposure to a recovery in a security that has experienced a large drawdown. And not only will it give you some exposure through that particular name, but if, let's say, the others are correlated as well, they may also participate in the recovery. So if you sell the stock, move into an ETF and hold it for 30 days, that's the minimum for Revenue Canada to recognize that a sale of property, then you at least don't run the risk of missing out on a recovery. This can even be done ETF to ETF. So when an ETF has suffered extreme losses and we see outflows and we see people selling it, I'm now more reluctant to say these are weak hands selling at the bottom when they shouldn't, right? Perhaps they are switching into another ETF with a similar but different enough index that will give them the exposure to the asset class, but will recognize for them at least a bit of a tax asset. So these things are happening in the market, and it's important to remain humble. Especially since we're believers in a certain sense, passive. I think passive is a bit of a misnomer. But we are believers in market cap weighting, shall we say, in the implicit pricing of the wisdom of the crowd. That's what I would like. Right. It's not as catchy as passive, right? But that's what passive means, right? It means that I believe that the market, through its free action of clearing a price on every single security, has all the information, or at least better information than I can hope to achieve by digging my nose in financial statements and books and so on. And I'm happy for the moment to kind of free ride on the coattails of every single market participant. You run into kind of perhaps distortions if everybody does that, right? But we're very, very far from that point, even though passive has been growing in terms of assets and activity, and the flows have been growing every single year. There are some academic studies which perhaps contest this point from a different angle, but we believe that the amount of trading activity happening naturally and natively especially U.S. securities, but even Canadian securities as well, is so high that the efficient market hypothesis still holds true to a certain degree within those securities. So it makes a lot of sense to do market cap weighting for core allocations and just keep costs low.
Well, that's reassuring. And I love this subject of tax loss selling because, especially in the vein that you just pointed out, which is that, you can go from single stock risk exposure to a diversified exposure in the same sector that previous single stock holding you had occupies. So not only do you get the tax loss harvesting happening, you get risk management.
Right, exactly.
Improvement. Exactly. Significant risk management improvement. And that ultimately leads to what some call tax alpha.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Where you captured the tax loss and now you've lowered your cost base against that existing holding. You've moved laterally into something similar
exactly.
or something with more diversification.
Yeah.
And you're setting yourself up to reap the capital gains rewards of having tax loss harvested. So that's a less than obvious value added area that advisors can really bring value to their clients
and
point out because it's not visible in the day-to-day conversations in the market.
Yeah.
But as you said, and it's not necessarily obvious in the flows that you're seeing.
Correct.
Where yeah. you know, you could say, you know, that's a mistake.
Right.
That
right.
was a mistake. But then the right person comes along and says, hey, wait a minute. Where did the trading come from? What was the origination?
Exactly.
What was the point of origin of that trade? Right.
Yeah.
And when you can, if you could identify that, that would be wonderful.
That's right.
It's hard.
It's hard to identify it because ETF trading yeah. happens on open market, right? Without, besides the broker codes that you can see on the exchanges and so on, we really don't know who's trading what, where, or why, right? We can only aggregate the behavior and see what's happening. One of the patterns that we do see in the aggregate that's related to the subject of tax loss selling is inflows into sectors, for instance, that have been beaten down because people are selling their stocks and moving to the ETF. And you might expect, as we were saying before, that investors who really did like those stocks and, as you were saying before, like them at 40% down, 50, 60, 70% down, even more. We don't actually see that cyclical pivot back into the stock to the same degree, right? What I mean to say is the tax loss inflows into certain beaten down sectors tend to be a little bit sticky. So this is an example of a kind of perhaps investor bias, a cognitive bias, helping investors, right? The bias, of course, is to take no action or to just have inertia, right? The bias is to value your bird in hand more valuable than the two that are in the bush, right? Like, and that kind mm-hmm. of investor inertia or a reluctance to kind of move away from the holdings they currently have can be quite harmful in some contexts. But in this one, it's helpful, right? As you're saying before, if you have moved from a single security into a better diversified ETF, and then you kind of stay there because you're lazy, your laziness is acting in a way that helps your risk management practice.
It's benign. Yeah.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we can talk about investor biases and cognitive and behavioral biases quite a lot. There's, I believe, hundreds of them that have been identified. But it's also important to remember that sometimes these biases aren't necessarily negative. They're just behavior patterns, which can be benevolent or benign or malevolent, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any, you know, chasing of performance going on? Mm-hmm. I mean, are you seeing any trends where investors are chasing the hot thing? Are investors chasing AI?
Yeah. So I don't know, Pierre, should we talk about crypto? I'm always reluctant a little bit to talk about it because...
Well, I do want to talk about crypto.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm curious also to find out from you what's happening with like flows into international markets like sure. Japan, Korea.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what's you know, with the resurgence in equities in Japan, are you seeing investors gravitate in that direction?
There have been a couple billion of flows, especially in the US, into the Japan equity products. There's a new generation of products from the likes of Franklin Templeton, for instance, that are much cheaper. We've received a lot of client questions on Japan because I believe there's some renewed optimism there. So we definitely kind of start the conversation with the cheapest and most efficient ways to get exposure there. So definitely some client interest on the subject for instance, other emerging markets, South Korea. It's an interesting conversation piece because some of the index providers consider South Korea to be part of the emerging markets still, right. like MSCI, but others like FTSE and Vanguard indices track these indices, consider them developed. So depending on which products you use, you may be getting gaps in your exposure. And I believe that South Korea is one of those areas where depending on the kind of suite of products you're using, you may not have exposure to what is really one of kind of the beating hearts of kind of the Eastern Hemisphere's kind of technology center, right? Samsung,
right.
LG, headquartered there. There was the recent launch of a K-pop ETF because South Korean, the entertainment industry has received a massive kind of like a cultural boom going on there with streaming shows and movies winning Oscars and so on. So like right. there's been more interest there for sure. But interestingly, that ETF, and I believe the ticker symbol is K-pop, launched around the peak of that frenzy of interest, and it's had a bit of a decline since then. So that's an example of very, very interesting thematic ideas often launching right. near the top. Not to say that the idea isn't bad in the long term, but this is a pattern that we've seen very much in the ETF industry over the years. Themes like working from home or virology and immunology, for obvious reasons, start to receive a lot of interest, a lot of headlines, a lot of inflows, product development launches, but then the performance never quite matches the expectations because the the very launch of the ETF itself could be the kind of indicator that the frenzy of interest has itself reached its zenith. And that's what we've seen even in crypto, right? To bring the conversation back to then, earlier this year in January, there was enormous headlines around the ETF world. I know my U.S. counterparts were agog with the information happening in the flows around these nine ETFs that were launched all on the same day holding spot Bitcoin. We had that in Canada since 2021, right?
That's right, yeah.
We had spot Bitcoin ETF since 2021. And interestingly, that was a local peak in the price of Bitcoin. And the billions of dollars of flows in Canada that went into those products, I told everybody that was asking me the questions, this asset is still very new, it's nascent, it's extremely speculative, it routinely has 80% drawdowns.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened. The billions of dollars of flows into the Canadian suite of products in 2021, it's very quickly became 2 billion, and not because of outflows, but because of price declines, right? And those investors were underwater for a very long time, I believe, with the recent highs in the asset, in the crypto asset space. They may have started to break even, but we're still seeing outflows into the U.S. products because they're, you know, they're not necessarily better, but they are, they have lower fees. They have the appearance of higher liquidity, even though, of course, liquidity is the same. It's a single crypto asset and it's one custodian, chiefly Coinbase, that's, acting as the, kind of, unit holding, but the asset holding custodian for almost all of the ETFs. So there are, you know, bottlenecks and choke points in the ecosystem for this very new space. That's not to say that's fear, uncertainty, or doubt or panic, but it definitely means it's very, very new. And there's a lot of reason to suggest to clients, tread very carefully here, right? Certainly, if you're able to absorb losses and you wish to experiment, you know, we're not in the market of telling people that they're wrong, you know, but we are, we do see it our job as ETF analysts to kind of educate people on the risks, particularly in uncharted waters. The crypto space is still rife with them, even though depending on who you talk to, there's an enormous amount of promise as well, but that may be a long way off.
I think, you know, there's a couple things. Like, one is that, you know, you mentioned Coinbase. You know, it's interesting that, you know, that the access, that this choke point to, which is the doorway, but it's the passageway to getting the getting cryptocurrency, is not a blockchain itself.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So you still have, like, until, you know, blockchain becomes the access point, you know, which you can do, obviously, you can buy these cryptocurrencies directly, without having to go through an intermediary. But right now, the biggest intermediaries are still not DeFi, right? They're not.
Right.
So that's one thing. I think, you know, I think that's, you know, largely what, you know, to your point, it explains why, you know, allocation suggestions aren't bigger than 1%.
Right. Right.
Yeah. In most cases.
Unless you're talking to a maximalist who says that it should be 100% and perhaps even more if you want to mortgage your house and so on.
Right.
This is the problem with discussing this topic. It's because on the internet there are... There's definitely a bit of a selection bias in the voices that you will encounter when you try to do research on the subject. You'll go to you know, forum threads and social media and so on, and you will encounter very quickly maximalists, some of whom are, you know, economics professors, right?
Right.
They've written books on the subject. Some of them are CEOs of companies. So they appear, you know, like they're speaking from a position of credibility, and they will be saying that it's the only safe and sensible asset to own in a world of currency debasement and so on. Listen, you know, there are some people who believe that. And what's amazing to me is that now BlackRock, being one of the largest players in the space very suddenly, right?
Yeah.
Even their CEO Larry Fink was saying, you know, if you don't trust your government, then perhaps, you know, a little bit of Bitcoin makes sense because it's kind of like government-proof money. It's amazing to me that one of the heads of one of the largest Wall Street firms would be saying such a thing. But of course, there is a client base out there to whom that is a marketing pitch, right? So it's, and if you study history, right, the claim by itself on its face is not impossible, right? That gold could be seized or that currency could be debased. It's, you know, it's happened to greater empires, right, than the United States. You know,
It's not an endorsement, though, right? I mean,
when
somebody like Larry Fink comes along and says, if you're one of these people,
right,
you know, we have something for you. We have this access for you. It's not that we're telling you what to do. You can do it through our vehicle.
Exactly.
And you know,
it says a lot about the nature of the ETF landscape. Precisely that.
It's agnostic.
That's right.
You know, to a large degree, it's, you know, if you're looking for access to, you know, to India, we have this India ETF. Looking for access, like we're in the business of making access, possible.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So speaking of access now, one of the other areas that is getting a lot of focus is alternative assets.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing happening in the alternative space in terms of adoption? Like, are there any distinctive flows that you can point to that show, you know, investors taking a greater interest? I mean, diversification is the hardest. You know, it's always having to say you're sorry for advisors, and it's always, you know, for investors, it's the hardest thing to stick to.
Yeah.
Unless you actually have a strict strategic, asset allocation program that you're investing in, and you're maintaining the discipline. But, you know, the perennial problem with advisors is the line item risk of, having or recommending alternative assets to their clients, and then having the client turn around and say, you know, when the stock market is booming, why do we own these alternatives?
Yeah.
Right. But do you see any like given the sort of weirdness of the market right now, or the wonkiness of the market, do you see investors sort of flowing into certain alternatives? Are they like going for the low hanging alternatives? Yeah. Or are they going for the more esoteric ones? What kind of alternatives are investors gravitating towards?
Yeah, really good question, Pierre. A bit of a kind of a little narrative arc precisely to kind of answer that. And it begins roughly in 2019 when Canadian regulators unified the rules around mutual fund regulations and commodity pools under a single framework, allowing for what they now call alternative mutual funds, right? So they're traditional mutual funds and alternative mutual funds. The alternative mutual funds, this designation under the filing regulation, allows for the mutual fund to have higher gross leverage, lesser limits on borrowing, different kinds of asset classes. And there was a flurry of launches and activity and innovation from likes of traditional hedge fund managers. Picton Mahoney launched ETFs with long, short, and market neutral strategies. Many of the kind of existing liquid alt ETFs in Canada refiled under this framework. So there were some hedge fund like ETFs in Canada that refiled, and there was a giant sweep of launches, and the space grew from a handful of ETFs that were kind of making do with current regulations, either with exemption or working under the restriction, to this new kind of regulatory framework. The space grew from a small handful to about 30 ETFs in Canada that we would classify as alternatives. But then what happened was, this was again in late 2019, the pandemic, right? I think the investor behaviors and attention very much turned elsewhere. The fact that there's this kind of wave of innovation had just occurred was kind of probably loosely forgotten. And then in the aftermath, people noticed that some of them zigged when the market zagged. Those achieved some inflows. Some of them very, very steadily and exactly in a market neutral context, just plugged away, achieving 4-6% returns in a year with some drawdowns, but not a lot. Others very much had equity exposure. We could see which ones they were. So some flows have happened in that area around that. But one of the unintended, and this is the kind of funny coda to the story, one of the unintended consequences around this innovation in the mutual fund space was not the development of highly complex and sophisticated liquid alt hedge fund strategies, although that, of course, happened. But instead, the launch of very plain vanilla, simple, lightly levered equity ETFs, right, filing under this framework. So the framework was introduced to allow for innovation and launches in the kind of hedge fund-like liquid alternative space. But it ended up being very successfully implemented for plain vanilla 1.25x lightly levered exposure into something like Canadian banks or even just the equity market, right? So those started to achieve hundreds of millions of dollars of inflows. And I should point out that the leverage that's embedded in these ETFs, the lightly levered category, they don't do a daily leverage like the Beta Pro or the Pro Shares ETFs.
Right.
They have like a trigger based rebalancing is roughly monthly. So it doesn't mean that there's no path dependency, but there's far less than there is in those with the daily leverage.
Right.
There's also not 200 or 300% leverage, as we've seen in some of the daily lever products in the US, but rather just 25%. And it's rebalanced on a trigger basis. So you really are getting 1.25 exposure to the market if you buy one of these products, but you have to pay borrowing costs, right?
Right.
So, and which are now significantly higher than they were when these products launched. So what was intended as a kind of regulatory, tailwind to innovation and improvement of Canadian portfolio experiences and outcomes ended up being just applied as a way to kind of like get more gearing to the market, which is not wrong for some investors to do, right? If you have a very stable income and you're young and so on, perhaps the market by itself doesn't give you enough exposure to itself. So you need to gear up a little bit, right? Or perhaps you've suffered some losses and you need to recoup and you still have a long time horizon. It may be time to apply a little bit of leverage. And these ETFs let you do it without a margin account, right? So we're seeing innovation, but just in a different area, right? Like you can be a gardener and you can kind of fertilize and kind of tend very carefully one area of your garden to see what blooms, but then look over your shoulder and then there's a jungle behind you all of a sudden that came up without you noticing or knowing about it. And that's kind of something that happens in the ETF market a lot.
Yeah. I mean, are there any trends? That's very interesting, first of all, you know, that the change in the rules was used to innovate, you know, lightly levered ETF,
exactly.
Like truly, you know, like not like, as you said, not like the Beta Pro,
right.
Not the daily, you know, the daily leverage, mm-hmm. but path dependency, but this more smooth approach
exactly
to providing 1.25x exposure to a sector.
Yeah.
Do you see any of the, like, you know, hedge fund like ETFs, like mm-hmm. 2 and 20 style strategies, like merger arbitrage, mm-hmm. and event driven, and managed futures.
Yeah,
are any of those capturing any great interest?
So, I think they're capturing some. Right. A little bit, you know, there's a startup out of Calgary, Accelerate, that has launched like these kind of type of strategies using merger arb and different kind of strategies. There are managed futures as well. There's one in particular in the US that did very well through the pandemic and achieved, again, a lot of follow on flows, but then kind of gave them back over time, which is to say it performed with the kind of low or zero or even mildly negative correlation that you'd expect from a strategy like that. So we are seeing some interest, but it tends to kind of follow performance at a low level with a slow burn. So I think that the investor growth in this space will come by watching the proving ground of performance, right? The ETFs are out there. They're implementing the strategies in real time. We can observe it. We can follow their prices on the exchanges. We can see their portfolios as they're reported on their websites. And I think that after like a track record of 3, maybe even 5 years,
right,
kind of winners that have demonstrated prudent risk management and so on, those will achieve some nibbles, right? But it will take patience, I think, on the part of providers, because investors have signaled interest, but they're still very tentative. Because many of these strategies are very active. They require a sophisticated degree of understanding. And so, investors have been acting with caution and prudence in this space.
Amazing. I mean, it's incredible what's happening, you know, how the space is changing, how it's becoming more and more sophisticated, how, you know, accessibility is changing, you know, in a universal way so that investors can access, you know, more, and build even, you know, pension or endowment style strategies using all these different instruments. I'm curious also, like, I mean, like when you consider, you know, where, you know, we've got all this equity risk, we've got all this bond market risk now. I mean, with the market, you know, with markets topping and bonds having bottomed and, you know, in some kind of a, you know, maybe in some sort of a recovery right now, especially in duration.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to see, you know, where the flows go. And you're right. I think, you know, I think to your point about performance of alternatives, you know, when people look back over, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 years of full performance versus what's happened in 2022, how did all these, you know, and you get to that 5-year mark and you look and you say, well, if I had maintained, you know, my 60-40 with a few, you know, Explore Holdings versus having a model portfolio that includes alternatives, how would I have done? You know, I think, you know, to some degree, people will look back and, you know, try to make decisions about the future from that, you know, based on that confirmation.
Absolutely.
Are you seeing, and finally, I did want to ask you about commodities. Are you seeing, like I mentioned managed futures a moment ago, but I'm just curious to know, like, given, you know, the higher for longer idea, are investors increasing, maintaining or decreasing exposure to commodities, commodities related ETFs?
So good question. You know, we look at both the Canadian and US context and we see slightly different stories playing out. Within Canada, I think investors probably already feel pretty commodity exposed if they have a home bias, right? If you have a home bias in Canada,
then you're the energy sector.
Exactly. Yeah. You'll hold all the producers and exporters mostly in your equity portfolio already. So adding a, for instance, a futures-based broad commodity ETF may not necessarily be the kind of solution that a client like that is looking for. That said, there have been kind of fits and starts around the space. You know, there were broad commodity ETFs in Canada launched many years ago that delisted and then relisted and then delisted and then relisted. Right. Interestingly, so there is now, again, a broad commodity ETF that you can get, but they're futures-based, right? So broad commodity ETFs, we find have the greatest value proposition and people are trying to forecast the space most broadly and want to act in a kind of short to medium term on fast moving recoveries. That is what I think those kinds of products that are futures based are most useful for. Because if you hold them persistently, some of them will have kind of newfangled quantitative means to try to reduce the impact of roll yield because the futures, of course, expire. The ETF can never take physical delivery. So the managers and, in fact, the index will sell short-dated futures and roll out to the longer part of the commodity curve. And what will end up happening over time is because commodities are expensive to store, generally speaking, and there are interest rates as well to arbitrage this. There is definitely a negative roll yield that kind of overlays the return path of the commodities over the very long term. So a futures-based ETF, you know, requires a whole level of client education, especially at National Bank. We try to kind of explain to people in detail how they work, and then they can decide whether or not they want to put them in the portfolio. And they have been implemented in portfolios, again, with success over these short periods when people feel they need for the coming 6 months, say, something that will participate in a kind of inflationary expansion, right? Like I've been dinged by inflation and my expenses in this way. I need to be able to kind of, ease the pain with another part of my portfolio, at least temporarily. We've had questions about things like materials and copper for this reason exactly, because these are physical commodities that copper, for instance, is not available in an ETF, unlike gold, silver, palladium, platinum. The investment metals can be physically purchased, but the base metals and materials and so on, there are futures-based ETFs, again, that hold those. But if you hold a basket of the miners and the producers, you are getting exposure without that futures roll yield. You get equity risk, you get management risk, you get operational risk, but at least you get the inflation protection as well that you're looking for. So yes, we've been getting a lot of questions on that, especially as inflation has reared its head and is now part of every conversation.
Daniel, what a whirlwind of a conversation.
Thank you, Bear. I think we covered a lot of ground. Yeah. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, I think we actually barely scratched the surface, you know. I think from our, you know, agenda items, there's probably some stuff we didn't discuss. So hopefully I'll be invited
back. Well, I hope we can get back together again soon, sooner rather than later, and maybe dig into some of these things. You know, more deep dives into what you're seeing. Cause I think advisors would love to know, you know, the things that you think about at night.
Keeps me up?
What you're reflecting on.
What lulls me to sleep? Things like
that. Yeah. Like what are the impulses that you're getting, from all this access of, you know, all this data that you're watching? I would love to get into that with you. So, Daniel, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Thank you, Pierre. It was a pleasure to be here.